welcome to the show. My guest today is a great guest. I know I say that every week, but those were all lies. This is the real great guest. Robert Duncan. He is the managing editor of Cream Magazine from 1975 to 76, basically the heyday of rock. And he continued to contribute to that magazine, as well as Rolling Stone, Circus, Hit Parader, and others, well through the 80s. He's written some books, including a Kiss biography, and he has a new book coming out titled Loudmouth. So we're going to talk about all this, and I really enjoyed hearing his stories. I was on the edge of my seat listening to these stories he had about being around some of the biggest rock stars of the 70s at the height of rock music, really. And I don't say this often, but I really think this is one of my best interviews that I've ever had, and it's mostly because of Robert's stories. What I love is just his brutal honesty. It's kind of rare in the music business, although maybe not for rock critics and certainly not for Cream Magazine in the 70s. If you watch the new documentary that's out now, you can see what it was like back then. And I guess what also strikes me about Robert and his stories is just how much cocaine was going on in the 70s. Sounds like it was really rampant back then, which I guess isn't too surprising. But anyways, I think you'll enjoy this episode. Well, welcome to my show here. You are the most known for, I guess, being the managing editor of Cream Magazine in the late 60s. And also, you've written a couple of books. You wrote a Kiss book, I think, which is one of your most popular sellers, right?
One of my that eclipses all other books by, you know, hundreds of thousands.
What is it about Kiss that, why do people, I mean, I like Kiss, I don't hate them, but it's just like, if there's all these people, like a lot of musicians that I interview, they are Kiss. That was like, it's got to be one of the most influential bands, which is really kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, it is really odd. You know, I'm not a Kiss fan either, but and I was managing an editor of Cream in like the mid 70s,
because right,
it didn't start till like 69, 70. But Kiss is like, you know, they're like, I discovered. Somebody asked me to write a book on Kiss, and I used to write a lot of magazine articles on Kiss because I discovered that when I was a freelancer, you could sell these magazine articles. You know, they didn't want to hear, you know, maybe about the Velvet Underground. They wanted to hear, the magazines wanted Kiss on their cover. So,
sure.
So I wrote a bunch of stuff about it, and a guy hooked me up with a publisher who wanted a book on it. And it was the first ever book about Kiss. Biography, such as it was, it's kind of tongue in cheek.
Yeah, definitely.
Some people got it, but Kiss, I have discovered this too, that Kiss is like the Beatles of their generation. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of the baseline around which people of a certain age begin and organize their musical life.
Right.
So.
So for you, growing up, you were born in Wisconsin, then you guys moved at a very young age. Where did you move to California at that point, or where did you?
Oh, no. We moved around the Midwest for a while. So Wisconsin and Chicago and Minneapolis. And then we moved to New York when I was in fourth grade.
Okay.
It roughly parallels the timeline in Loudmouth.
Okay.
Although I left out some of the movings around because.
Yeah. But you became a fan of the Beatles and the British Invasion. That was your Kiss. That was your generation, right?
Beatles were my Kiss.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I mean, because that's what I would expect a lot of musicians to say, oh, the Beatles were huge. But a lot of them growing up as a kid in the 70s, I felt like maybe they thought the Beatles was like their parents' music or something.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's funny because when we lived in Minnesota, I had a much older half brother, and he was a big bad boy, hot rod gangster kind of guy. Mm. And there's a character based on him in Loudmouth. But but I remember driving around in his hot rod and pouring out of the glaring from the dashboard was this guy singing about a hound dog. And I'm like, you know, I'm 7 years old and I'm like,
oh, wow,
what's going on? Mommy, get me out of here. You know,
isn't it crazy? You have those memories of the first time you hear something.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it was funny. So I was scared by Elvis. And then a few days later, I'm in school and I went to Catholic school and we had a music class where we learned to sing all the hymns. And I remember doing the Elvis, you know, in the music class.
Oh,
somehow I went from being intimidated to being attracted, like deeply attracted. And I remember it was the one time the nun called home to school. She called home and said, you know, we think your son has perfect pitch. And it was like the one good call from school, you know, ever.
Wow.
But that was because I was trying to sing like Elvis.
But so were the nuns or the Catholic people, were they okay with Elvis? Because he was a little risque back in the day.
Oh, no, they didn't know I was singing Elvis. I'm I'm a 7-year-old.
You weren't shaking your hips like Elvis then or anything.
No, I was sitting in my seat, but I was just trying to kind of do my little 7-year-old soprano version of Elvis.
And, okay. Yeah, and then
I spanned from Elvis Hound Dog to, you know, Billie Eilish. That's the arc of my listening career.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so it was around the age 12 that you actually started playing in bands, which was pretty young age to play in bands. And this was kind of in the your first band, or one of the first bands, was called Sky King. And you said this was kind of in the glam era, like Alice Cooper.
Right. Well, yeah, that was my high school band.
High school.
But I joined, and when I was in grade school, you know, right about the time I joined a band, I was a bad guitar player, but I wanted to be a rock star because now I had seen the Beatles. Now I had seen my generation. And after that was just, you know, life takes a left turn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it was funny. I was thinking about the other day, somebody was asking me about, you know, what was the music? And I'm thinking, well, just before the Beatles, and even during the Beatles, it was surf music.
Beach Boys, Ventures.
Yeah, Ventures. I mean, Ventures were just, they were the biggest band, you know, of the moment, you know, just before the Beatles. And so we played Ventures tunes and Telstar and all this stuff. And then I went on to, we started a band in high school. And, you know, that was all. The Sky King was named for there was a TV show, and it had a father and his daughter, and they flew around in an airplane and stuff. It was kind of cool. And, her name was Penny. So I called myself Penny in Sky King. So we were, you know, messing with the gender fuckery and all. And we were, you know, we were a real hardcore Stones-ish band.
Okay.
Early on.
Sure.
I mean, that was early 70s and
early.
And we were, I was just so off the charts, and I was, I would go crazy and jumping around and throwing beer on myself and crawling around on the floor and all this stuff. And I remember when punk started, one of the guitar players called me and said, "Hey, look what you started." Cause I was doing a lot of that really, really edgy stuff, early on.
Nice. But so you ended up moving to California, and yeah. I found this interesting. You told this story a few times where you randomly ran into Ed Ward, who's like a rock historian, editor and writer for Rolling Stone and Cream. Yeah. And you were kind of thinking of getting into writing for rock magazines and such. So do you feel like that was maybe like some sort of divine intervention? I mean, what are the odds that you're thinking about getting into that field and then you just randomly happen to run into this guy? I mean,
what are the odds? It's the same weird story how I met my wife, but yeah, Ed Ward I was looking for an apartment, a basement apartment,
were apartments super expensive back in the 70s in San Francisco? Because now I can't even imagine what the price is.
Well, they, you know, they, I think comparatively speaking, they were still cheaper. I mean, because it's
okay,
just
sure, yeah.
out of the ballpark now. But they were still expensive, you know.
Oh, okay.
100, 150 or 200 bucks a week. You're like, okay, well, that, you know, so I was looking for a cheap apartment, and I wound up at the end of a day out in Sausalito, and I saw a basement apartment for rent, and I pulled my car over and I ran over, and a guy comes running from the other direction and says, "I got it," you know, and I go, "Oh shit. All right." I said, "Do you mind if I look at it anyway?" Cause it was like the end of the day, no more apartments to look at. He says, yeah, you can look at it, but don't, you know, don't get any ideas. And I tell this story in loudmouth in a fictionalized form. And the guy, so I go into the apartment, I'm looking around, and the guy walks in and he puts down this box that he's carrying of his shit. And under it is a lanyard and a laminate, and it's a press pass. And I say, oh shit, you know, what do you write about? Or why are you a press guy? He says, well, I'm a writer and an editor, and I write for Rolling Stone and Cream, and I'm the West Coast editor of Cream and City Magazine, which was a San Francisco's magazine, and this and that. He just went on. He'd written for every magazine known to man. And it was like, oh shit, I'm kind of interested in getting involved in that field, because I had given up on bands. The final time the drummer explodes or the guitar player's girlfriend won't let him play, it was like, you know, all right, fuck this. I'm going to do something I can do all by myself. So, and so it turned out it was Ed Ward. And Ed Ward said, well, so he kind of, for a while, he made me his kind of editorial slave, and he would make me transcribe tapes for him back in the day.
Did you get paid for that?
He didn't pay me for it. No, he just kind of made me his slave, and he would then cook dinner. He was a big cook, still it. And he would cook dinner, and he would cook dinner mostly for me and this other guy, John Morthland, who was a early Rolling Stone writer. And John Morthland got hired to be the interim editor of Cream magazine in Detroit. And when he went there, he called me up and said, hey, you want to come be copy boy? This is after Ed had given me a couple assignments and kind of taught me what to do. But Ed Ward definitely was my mentor and instructor.
So, because back then there was no Zoom, there was no podcasts or YouTube. So you're doing a lot of these interviews with like a tape recorder. Like, are you doing them over the phone or in person? And then you were just transcribing them, right?
Well, yeah, I transcribed a few of Ed's tapes.
So were you kind of, did you starstruck at first when you're getting the first transcription? Is it a big rock star? And you're like, oh, wow, this is an interview with Bob Dylan or something. Or,
It seemed cool. You know, I was definitely starstruck. But when I started doing it myself, I always tried to do it in person. It's way better doing it in person. You know, you get to kind of see what a jackass they are in person. And I include myself in that. But, and there was phone interviews, but I resisted that because it's so much less to write about.
Mm-hmm.
I was starstruck, and I was, you know, I was kind of tongue tied, and I'd write down all these questions, and I'd be, you know, I was not an overly shy person, but I would suddenly turn a little bashful when I would be confronted with, oh, I don't know. And then again, there was, I interviewed Kiss early on.
Yeah. Wasn't that one of your first writing assignments? They were the opening act. It was before they were really big, right?
Yeah. When I was out in California, and Cream, when now Ed Ward has given me some assignments, and Cream called, or Ed called and said, hey, they want us to do a story on this band Kiss that's coming to town. Will you do it? And I'm like, of course, you know? And so I was invited out to dinner with Bill O'Coin, their famous manager, who was in Svengali, I guess. And then we went, and I interviewed the band, and I was there the day Paul came late to the interview. Mm-hmm. And it was the day he was out getting his famous rose tattoo on his shoulder from this tattoo artist named Lyle Tuttle, who used to do all the rock stars in the 60s, who I got a tattoo from as well. And, anyways, they were fine, you know.
So tell me, this might seem like
I went to see them. I was horrified.
Because I'm not a big Kiss fan. I mean, I like Kiss, but I don't know a lot about them. Some of these other people that have interviewed you, I know they know everything about Kiss. So for the novice fan, you got to go backstage. Now, how does you get to see them put their makeup on? Like, I always wonder, like, how long does that take? Especially back then, before they had probably now they just spray it on. But back then, I mean, are they just doing it themselves? Do they do it to each other? Like, do they have a makeup girl? Like, how does that all work?
Well, back, I saw them without their makeup and then with their makeup. So I missed the.
So you were actually like, that's like kind of behind the scenes, because before then, nobody had seen them without their makeup until the 80s or whatever they did, Unmasked or whatever, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And No, but I think I know from my friend Jan Uhelski, my co-editor at Cream, she did get to be backstage for, she got to go on stage with them. It's a famous story. She tells that in that Cream documentary that is just coming out.
I just saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She tells about that. And I think she said it took an hour for them to get that makeup on, and they did it. They did it themselves.
Okay.
But yeah, I was horrified when I first went there. I'm like, what is all this shit? What does this have to do with, music? I was like, and they had the big Kiss sign and Gene was spitting blood, and they were really doing pretty much everything they do as would go on to do as headliners, as an opening act. And it was just like, oh, wow.
Who were they opening for? Do you remember?
God, I wish I remember, but I have no idea.
So you're
probably look it up, because it was Winterland Ballroom.
Okay.
I should look it up.
So you're a contributor to Cream Magazine. You wrote some stuff, and then only in 75 to 76, you rose to the top of the ranks pretty quick. You were the managing editor. I mean, that's a pretty big role for that magazine, right? And at the prime of rock, mid 70s. I mean, I can't think of a cooler job at that point.
Yeah, it was a great job, and it was astonishing because, I started, I think, doing freelance stuff for him in like 74.
Yeah.
And Mortham went to Cream and called me up and said, you want to come and be copy boy? Well, the reason Mortham was there as interim editor was after Dave Marsh, who was like the famous founding editor, or basically the founding editor, they couldn't find anybody that they liked. And basically Lester would drive out the editors. Lester Bangs was there by this time, and he would like, I don't like that guy, fuck this guy. And he would harass him. And the guy would eventually say, I can't work with Lester. And
because what is Lester's role again? Is he editor too? Or what is?
Well, he was the star writer
writer. Okay.
The voice of the magazine. And well, so what happened was, he kept chasing away editors. People don't realize this. So he would chase them away, and finally it came down to, I was very tight in the family, the Cream family at this point. And I was, you could see, I mean, I guess I had a knack for it. I was a great cheerleader. I would be like, oh, hey, we all got to do this. We all got to do that. And I was always telling jokes and shit. And so the publisher said, hey, you got to ride home tonight? No. He said, well, come, I'll give you a ride home. And he took me down to his car. He says, hey, you want to be editor of the magazine? And I'm like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. But it'll never work as long as if Lester is perceived to be, working for me or reporting to me.
Oh.
It has to be. I said, so here's what I recommend. And again, I'm like 22. I'm thinking, what a fucking genius. And so I said to the publisher, I said, let's do this. Let's make Lester the editor. So he'll be at the top of the masthead, and we'll invent this new title for me, managing editor.
I'll be
under Lester.
Okay.
And I'll tell Lester, he doesn't have to do any of the organizational shit or the other than the creative work. And I'll do all that stuff, and I'll edit him as he needs it and as he wants it. And we did that, and it worked like a charm.
Hmm.
I mean, it worked great. And Lester and I were really close friends anyways.
So,
we became very close friends.
So then what happened? Because you were only there from 75 to 76, and then you stormed off and quit because you didn't like the new editor. There was another editor that was hired? Or
No. I got in a fight with the publisher.
The publisher, I'm sorry.
The publisher, Barry Kramer, who I actually liked, although he could be very annoying. Lester and him just fought like crazy. He was Lester's just bête noir. And, but I got along with him, but I did some irresponsible stuff, and he was like, okay, I'm holding your paycheck, this week. And I go, well, no, you can't do that. And he says, yeah, I'm going to do it. So I said, all right, well, fuck it. And I went home and I packed up my car and I drove back to New York.
And wait. What was the irresponsible stuff you did?
Oh, I left. I went. I just kind of disappeared for a couple of days at some point. And
what were you doing?
I was having I had a girlfriend in New York, and I was having problems with the girlfriend in New York. So I'm like, okay, I got to go smooth that out. And I came back, but he's like, okay, I'm not going to fucking pay you. And he didn't pay us much anyways, but
really, you didn't make good money as the editor of one of the biggest rock magazines in the height of rock?
No. I mean, I believe I made $200 a week, which to me was okay. It was okay. You know, but at least by the time I left there, it was $200 a week. But so, yeah, that was, you know, and they were, I'm not sure. Maybe Kramer got kind of rich off it. But in the end, I think he squandered it all, you know, and, you know, he squandered it on drugs and cars and whatever.
Yeah. Well, so you continued to write for Cream until 81, but you also wrote for Hit Parader, Circus, Rolling Stone. These are all magazines that I read as a kid in the 90s. And you were actually offered a job to be the editor of Circus, but you denied that because you wanted to write books.
Yeah. Well, I you know, and again, it astonishes me. I was like 22. I left Cream, came back to New York. People started calling me, say, hey, you want to do something for this and that? And that's when the Jerry Rossberg from Circus called me up and said, you want to be editor of Circus? And I thought, well, look at this. I'm on a roll. I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to write the great American novel and, you know, and then I'm out of here, you know, and I didn't know it was going to take me this long to get to the great American novel, yeah, so I turned on Circus and I was working and I made up with the publisher of Cream. And so I was writing for Cream all the time. And I wrote for every rock magazine that there was. There was a magazine called Gig. There was Phonograph Record Magazine. And I can't even remember all the others.
So do you like doing that? Like working kind of like as a, I guess you'd call it freelance for a bunch of magazines rather than being under one magazine, or what's better?
Well, there was nothing better than working at Cream, because Cream was just really, you know, unfettered. You could pretty much do what you wanted. And the other writers were really good. And the freelancers were really good. It was an amazingly high quality of work for such a disorganized, wacky, you know, party hardy organization. And you just had tremendous, tremendous freedom. That was probably not the best thing to learn early on, because later on when I had to have other jobs, it was like, fuck this. What the hell?
So was there just a lot like in that movie, the Cream documentary, which I recommend everybody check it out. It was cool. They interviewed the drummer from Red Hot Chili Peppers, Chad Smith. And he said he's a kid and he looked at the Cream magazine. He's like, hey, this place is just like down the street from where I live. I'm going to go there. And he just shows up and Alice Cooper's like walking out. Was there a lot of that kind of stuff going on when you worked there, like rock stars coming in and out?
Well, there was some of that. And some of, like, you know, any band that came through town, and every band came of every size came through Detroit, and Detroit had a kind of mystique and still does. But so we would be, you know, there was a lot of partying with rock stars, you know, not a ton of them came by the office, but I know Iggy did and Alice Cooper did. And, you know, the publisher used to be the manager for Mitch Ryder, who I don't know if anybody remembers, but he was fantastic singer, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. And so we would be out. I mean, I remember one time we went to see the Faces, and we would just expect to, we'd go partying afterwards. And we went to see the Faces when Ron Wood was still playing in the Faces.
Was that with Rod Stewart too? Was he in that?
That was Rod Stewart and Ian McLagan. It was really a great band before Rod Stewart turned into, you know, kind of kitsch, schmaltz. But so I remember we're back at the hotel we go back to the hotel with the Faces, and we're in one of the guys from Cream's van, and Ron Wood walks back out of the hotel, and I said, hey, Ronnie, come on, get in. We're going, you know, we'll go somewhere or whatever. And so he wanted to go to, we went to Bobby Womack's house, you know, the great R&B singer. And he wrote It's All Over Now, you know, because I used to love her, but it's all over now. I mean, so we went there with Ron Wood and who knows who else. And Ron Wood and Bobby Womack jammed, sang, and played, you know.
Wow. just for fun. Like you're in a private concert, basically.
Yeah. So it was stuff like that happened a lot.
And, yeah. Tell me this story because I heard you talk about this one too. So this is like around 80, 81. You go to a party in New York City because this is totally random. Your friend is a stage manager for Liza Minnelli. And so you're invited to this party with like all these A-listers. You said Meatloaf was there, Harvey Keitel, Al Pacino, Lucille Ball, Gregory Peck, and you run into your old pal Gene Simmons from Kiss, who's dating Diana Ross. I mean, did you get to, this is before cell phones, so you can't get selfies with these people, but are you getting autographs or like Polaroids or something? Or?
Well, you know, I'm a guest at the party, so I kind of have to be pretend like I belong there because I didn't feel like I belong there. But this was my childhood buddy married Liza Minnelli because he was a stage manager on Broadway. And when he turned 30, he told her, he says, oh, you got to have a giant party and invite all your friends in to their Upper East Side apartment, which he did. She did. And he couldn't take selfies, but at some point I would, you know, we'd go up there and just, they'd drink all their booze and take all their cocaine. And so at one point I'm jumping on the couch and I'm making long distance calls. People don't know that calling long distance on a landline used to cost a bunch of money.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
I was calling everybody I know going, guess where I am? Guess who's over there in the room? And I was goofing on the whole experience, but yeah, it was, and then Gene showed up, Gene Simmons, and I can't imagine, I've talked about this, I can't imagine, but he thought, I'm going to a party with Liza Minnelli and Hollywood folks, Martin Scorsese and De Niro. And
Scorsese was there and De Niro?
Because they were getting ready to do a movie, him and Liza Minnelli did New York, New York. And oh my God, Farrah Fawcett and Ryan O'Neal. Anyways, Gene must have been mystified.
Jeez.
But you know, I've told this story, but Gene Farrah Fawcett, who was, do people know Farrah Fawcett?
I know, but I'm old. Yeah, she was a big deal in the 70s. She was a big sex star.
Angels, and she was
sex symbol, I guess.
Pin-up girl in America.
Yeah. Everyone had that poster
Every boy had the certain poster on his wall. Anyways,
was that the one in Shawshank Redemption, right? Isn't that Farrah Fawcett? At one point, I think he changes the poster. I feel like it is.
No, it's like Rita Hayworth. I think it, because that was a period piece.
Okay.
Yeah, it was something like that. I think it was Rita Hayworth, but
anyways, yeah. So
Farrah Fawcett's there with her boyfriend, Ryan O'Neal, who was famous for the movie Love Story.
Yeah. I know him.
Well, Paper Moon and all this shit. And you know, I remember at one point walking into the bedroom, you know, I was just completely off the chain. And I walk in the bedroom and Ryan O'Neal's sitting there with the largest mound of white powder you've ever seen. And I said to him, oh, hey, and he's snorting, you know, and I said, it was cocaine. And I said, hey, can I have some? You know, he's like, oh no, man, I don't have enough.
You know, and wow.
It had topographical features.
Like in Scarface, Al Pacino. That's what I'm picturing.
It was like that.
Wow.
Anyway, so at some point, 5 a.m, you know, everybody's left except for me and my wife, and that might have been my girlfriend at the time.
Okay.
And my friend Mark, who's married to Liza, they were there, and Ryan O'Neal and Farrah Fawcett, and they're trying to get me out of there because once I get going, I'm a maniac.
And, you mean like with like booze and coke and all this stuff, or what?
Well, I just have tremendous stamina. I can do it completely. I don't need drugs. I was never a big coke.
Okay.
Well, I can drink all night and just have, I can go on for days. Cause I don't know. I still kind of have it. And, so they're like, you know, we gotta go to bed. Come on. It's 5 or 5:30 in the morning. So I said, well, I lost my jacket. You know, what happened to my jacket? And it was like just a windbreaker, but I'm making a big deal. I'm walking around going, I'm looking everywhere in the house and I'm going, somebody stole my fucking jacket. You know, Lucille Ball stole my jacket or something. And I'm just riffing on this thing.
Yeah.
And then Farrah Fawcett comes out of the bathroom and she says, is this your jacket? And she has my ordinary black windbreaker. And I'm like, yes, that's my jacket. She found it hanging in the bathroom. And so I went and I used to do a thing when I was drinking. I learned how to do, you know, life-saving, Red Cross life-saving when I was a kid. And I learned how to, you know, carry somebody who's heavier than you and all this. Well, she wasn't heavier than me, but I used to, in bars and at parties, I would grab the biggest person I could find and run around and put them on my back. And that was my drunken feat of strength. So I grabbed Farrah Fawcett and I threw her up on my shoulder and I'm running around the marble apartment and I'm just jumping and dancing and just being, you know, I'm thanking, this is my thanking her for finding my check. And Ryan O'Neill is there. My friend Mark is saying, dude, come on, put her down. You know, he's just being my old friend.
Sure.
But Ryan O'Neill says to him, no, don't interfere. You know, he's like, he thinks he's going to be the emergency commander on the spot. And you know, he thinks I'm going to like jump out the window with them. I don't know what. So instead of stopping, I went and grabbed Liza and I had both Liza and Elliot.
Oh, please tell me there was a picture of this or a video or something.
No selfies in the top. My only picture is my wife was sitting there. So she'll corroborate. But anyways, I ran around. Eventually I put him down and I would not respond to Ryan's, you know, in trying to stop me.
Yeah, that would have been bad if he had had a mountain full of coke too. You know, people do weird stuff on that.
Well, he thought he was okay. I'm the sober minded one. And anyways, that
interesting.
That's a famous story from that party.
Wow, I tried, that's crazy.
You know, I tried to Loudmouth is a fictionalized memoir, more or less.
Yeah,
and which is a lazy way of describing it. It's got a lot of other stuff in it, and it's got exaggerations and it's got, you know, edits in my life and everything. I, at one point I did have that story in the manuscript and I'm like, well, shit, this isn't rock and roll. I gotta kind of touch base with all the little anecdotes have to touch base with rock and roll. So
I'm glad you told it here. 'Cause that was a great story.
Yeah, it's a funny story. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I told it on somewhere else, and now they said, "Oh, you got to come on this other show," and so I'm going to be on some national radio show at the end.
Oh, cool! Very cool. So another thing that you did that was really cool, you said you interviewed Bruce Springsteen, and you said that he told you that that was one of the best articles ever written about him. What year was that?
That was 78, I believe.
Okay.
I had met him a few times and we had a really cool experience that I slightly fictionalized for the book. It's the intro to the book is where he invited me down to Cleveland and we hung out and drove around in this crazy friend's car all afternoon. And it was just a wild afternoon. And I don't want to wreck the intro to the book because it's my favorite part.
Okay.
But anyways, we went down to the long story I wrote on him was we went down to I was invited down to go on tour with him in the South for a few dates to ride on the bus. And we went to Houston and New Orleans and Jackson, Mississippi. And first of all, you got a lot of flavor going on with those cities, especially New Orleans. And I interviewed him and I was pretty sure, okay, this is the best interview I've done. And it had a lot to do with him in that he was not, you know, he wasn't drunk or high. He didn't really drink and he didn't really get high. So he made sense. You know, I interviewed Aerosmith at the time and it's like, you kind of got to throw out the interview. It's like, it was just so stupid. And, but Bruce was great. And the shows were just fantastic. And of course the atmosphere walking around New Orleans with Clarence Clemons when he got like, and he got hassled by a cop there. We got accused of walking out on a check from a restaurant that we had never been in. And it was just a white cop hassling a large black man. And it was full of colorful incidents. And, so I wrote it for Cream and I thought, okay, that's probably the best thing I've ever written. And Bruce was, as maybe the continuation of this tour, he was coming back to New York and he was doing like his first Madison Square Garden gig. It was like his homecoming to New York, little New Jersey boy homecoming to New York. And he, so we got invited, we got on the list, and they had so many people wanted to go. They put him in this, they put all of us back, the backstage became the after show party was like a big kind of employee cafeteria somewhere in the bowels of Madison Square Garden. And there was like rock stars there. I can't remember who, but rock stars and politicians and, you know, rich people. And it was just this glittery crowd and kind of gross glittery to me. But anyways, my wife and I went, we were sitting way in the back of the room. We were sitting way against the back wall in the room. And Springsteen, after the show, came in the front door of that, walked past every rock star and every politician and every, you know, rich dude, and came right back to the table and sat with us, and who were nobody, and said to me, he says, I just got to tell you, that was the best story anybody wrote about me since John Landau wrote the famous The Future of Rock story, that basically helped Springsteen become the future of rock and Landau become his manager. So that was very gratifying. And, you know, he was a nice guy. He invited me down the shore, but I didn't have the money to go down there. I was a broke ass freelancer.
Wow. That's a cool story though.
Yeah, it was great. And I felt like everybody's looking at us. All the actually famous or glittery people are looking at us like, who the fuck are they?
Well, so another band that you had a run in with, was Blue Oyster Cult, because you said that your wife was friends with them and that she actually lived with them. So was that before you guys were dating? Because, or was that while you were dating? Cause I would not want my girlfriend or wife or whatever to be living with a rock band, especially in the '70s. That sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, they're actually pretty tame guys. No, it's funny. Yes, she lived with them with her own boyfriend. She went out for a long time with another guy who wrote about music, and he then went on to write lyrics for Richard Meltzer. He went on to write lyrics for the Blue Oyster Cult. And wow. So he became one of their lyricists. Even before they were the Blue Oyster Cult, so they had a big house out in Long Island, and they all lived together. You know, it was the hippie days. So it was like 69 or even 68. I can't remember.
Okay.
They were Stock Forest Group, and then they were Soft White Underbelly, and then they became Blue Oyster Cult. But I got to know them separate from her, because I was writing for Cream, and I went and did a story and got to be friendly with them. And then I met my wife, and that was one of the ways we connected. Oh. I met my wife. Just, you want to talk about weird things. I met my wife. I chased a girl. I came out of a bar having had some drinks, and two girls were walking past the bar, and I ran out and I kind of grabbed one of them. And I said, "Hey, you want to have a drink?" And she's like, "Get your hands off me." And then I walked backwards for, you know, a couple blocks, and they were ignoring me. And then finally I said, "Look, hey, where are you girls going?" And finally she answered, we're going to the Bottom Line, which was a big club in New York back in the day, and where Springsteen played, as a matter of fact, launched kind of Born to Run there. But, and I said, "Well, hey, you know, I can get you in for free. You go to the Bottom Line," 'cause I knew all the publicists and I'd been working in the so-called business for a couple of years. And she said, "Well, we're already getting in free." And I said, "What? Why are you getting in free?" I was like, just crestfallen. And she said, "Well, my friend is a singer," and that was this woman who went by Helen Wheels, and "I'm a photographer." I said, "All right." And this is, I had just gotten back to New York from Cream. So I said, "You're a photographer." I said, "Well, all right, what's your name?" And she said, "Ronnie Hoffman." And I said, "Ronnie Hoffman, I'm Duncan from Cream. I sent you a check last week," because I used to do the editorial checks. And so it was like, "All right, okay." So then they came back.
Because that's before Facebook, so you don't know what the person looks like that you're getting. Yeah.
No,
that's,
I didn't.
Funny.
So and then it turned out we both knew Blue Oyster Cult, and we both knew this guy, John Morthland. In fact, the next morning, John Morthland calls her apartment and says, hey, this guy Duncan is back in town from Detroit, and I think you might like to meet him. And she said, well, he's right here. And
that's cool.
So, yeah, it was. So, yes.
So, Blue Oyster Cult, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie. Did you have a run in with him?
I interviewed David Bowie, and he was, you know, he was great. I love Bowie, and he was a great, even very kind of sober interview. It was nothing, I guess it was between cocaine bouts, you know.
Okay.
He was great. He didn't look terrible either. I think he had cleaned up by this time. I don't know what, it was late 70s.
What about Freddie Mercury? He's always crazy. Was he ever calmed down?
Freddie Mercury, I interviewed backstage they were playing, you know, a big arena date in Michigan when I was working at Cream. And I remember, you know, I wasn't a huge Queen fan. I like them and respect them more now.
Hmm.
But I remember Freddie, it was like, I had a sense. Now it's funny because I still have the tape of this and I found it recently, but I thought, God, all he wanted to talk about was shopping. We talked about, cause I came from New York. He says, oh, I love Bloomingdale's and this and that. And I'm like, well, I'm not a big shopper, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I found it a little boring, but it was, but it's funny. There's a site called rocksbackpages.com, and they, part of what they do, they archive rock critics tapes and stuff.
Oh.
And so I had to send this off to them. I sent this off to them and I listened to it and I was like, oh shit, I have totally, it was a great interview. And I was, Freddie was perfectly interesting. And I just was, you know, I was just trying to be a snotty 22-year-old.
So. What about Keith Richards? I mean, that's a legend. Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
What was he like?
I met Keith and Ron Wood did a tour as the New Barbarians. It was basically Ron Wood was writing songs and so they did an arena tour where they had a big band with all these heavyweight musicians. I remember only Stanley Clark, the mostly jazz bassist. He was their bassist, and I remember because I rode it was fantastic. We they put us all in limousines and drove us out to New Jersey to a private airport where there was like a 727 parked, and you get out of the car and you just walk right up stairs into the plane. And the plane, the front part of the plane was like a pub, and they called it the pub, and it had like a British bartender behind the bar. It had a bar.
Wow.
A British bartender, you know, like you know, tufted leather chairs, they're all bolted down, they're all, you know, airplane approved, but it was like oh shit, this is just too cool. So but anyways, and we flew to I have a version of this story in the book, but I changed the locations. We flew to Baltimore and played down there. It's like an hour flight, and afterwards we wound up back in the hotel in New York, and I was supposed to do this interview with Woody. And he kept telling me, oh, any minute, man. But we're all having a good time. Now we're just drunk and carrying on. And at one point when we got back, come walking in from the adjoining bedroom is Keith. And he's carrying his, you know, squared off bottle of Tennessee whiskey, Jack Daniels. And we get introduced, and you know, he's just like, it's like, okay, that's he's just like Keith. And he would talk.
Yeah.
And he was, I don't know, have you ever seen the Mike Myers parody of Keith? Where he told,
I think so, yeah.
And that's how he talked. You're like, I can't understand a word he's saying.
Yeah.
And at some point somebody came to the door, a woman came to the door. And Woody, Ron Wood answered the door, and Keith looked over and saw who it was and started going, you know, that pre-verbal. And it was, he was screaming, and I'm like, okay, something's going on. And then Woody said, yeah, he's not, she's a reporter from NME, the paper, the English paper, and he's kind of mad at her for some reason. But it was great. And Ian McLaughlin was this wonderful, he was playing in the band, wonderful keyboardist and composer in the end. But at one point I'm like, shit, you know, it's like 4 a.m. I better call my girlfriend and tell her, be a little late. And,
Were you able to decipher his ramblings then into an interview? Well,
occasionally, you know, occasionally, but it was fun because it was just a bunch of guys shooting the shit, and they were completely let me just shoot. I was shooting the shit with them.
That's awesome.
A bunch of drunken guys just talking, you know? And so I said to Ron Wood, I said, hey, can I use the phone? He says, yeah. And he takes me to the bedroom and, you know, gestures, there's a phone by the bed, a landline, because there were no cell phones, kids.
Yeah.
And so I sit down on it's a white bed, white shag rug. It's an all white room. And I pull the white phone towards me and I pick up and I, you know, I'm starting to dial, or I did dial, and I got my girlfriend. And, Woody comes back in the room. This is how I tell it in loudmouth. Woody comes back in the room and he's like, oh, and he says, sorry. And he moves the phone a little bit. And I realize I have snowplowed another large mountain of white powder onto the white shag rug. And, and he's like, there's some left. So he's like cleaning it up, putting it in a little piece of paper. And I'm like, oh, you know, they let you be one of the guys and then you fucking look the drugs. So
rule number one, hanging out with rock stars is don't screw up. Don't mess with their cocaine.
Yeah. He was so nice. He couldn't have been nicer. Ron Wood is a very nice guy. And he was like, oh, don't worry about it. And you know, whatever, he has $50 million. He has $500 million. Who knows?
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so we could go on and on and on about rock stars. Let me do at least one more. Do you have a story about interviewing Jimmy Page? I mean, that guy's a legend too.
I just did a short interview with Jimmy Page, but my, you know, it was at an event. It was a red carpet thing, and so I got to ask. Yeah, I asked him three stupid questions. So nothing in depth. This is like, I think, the last interview before he let his hair go white. You know, he still had the dyed black hair.
Mm-hmm.
He had the black hair that he had all his career. And then not long after this, maybe I scared him into letting his hair go white. But my favorite part of that is, it was on video, the interview. And, when we were editing it back at the shop, it was, I said to the editor, I said, oh, you got to give me a copy of that, you know, meeting Jimmy Page, because I love Jimmy Page's guitar playing. I've loved it in every, whatever he was with the Yardbirds. I saw the Yardbirds, by the way, with him. And
that's cool.
And with when he played on that first Joe Cocker album, I was like, oh my God, I got to get that, because it's Jimmy Page. So I was a big fan. And I said, so you got to give me that tape. Give me a copy of this. It was tape at the time. Instead he edited me a little video of Jimmy Page just going, hello, Bob. And so I have on my website, I have hello, Bob.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. That's something. So then as time changes into the 80s, you were not a fan. I'm a big fan of metal, heavy metal, glam metal, rock, hair metal, whatever I guess you'd call it. You were not a fan of heavy metal. You had a lengthy article about how it was abysmal and terrible, horrible, stupid music, barely music at all. Have you backed off on that a little bit, or do you still feel that way?
Well, I think that was in my book, The Noise.
Okay.
And I think you will find, like a lot of things I write, is tongue in cheek. And it's also, and I'll bet you I should go look it up in the damn book, but I'm sure that at some point I turn the corner and I go, but it's this. So I think whoever first kind of dug that out neglected to dig out the subordinate clause that begins with but. And that, you know, I'm just trying to, I'm being provocative. And so some heavy metal I like. If you call Blue Oyster Cult heavy metal, I've been listening to them all my life.
Or Sammy Hagar, you've interviewed him, right?
Well, I met him one time. I had to sing a song to him, but in my role as a an advertising copywriter, because you can't make any money when you have a couple of kids, as I did, you have to get a real day job. And that was my day job. And one time I had to present a radio spot to Sammy Hagar. And so it was a jingle spot. So I sang it, which was kind of funny. Just me and.
Yeah. Are you still, that was the ad agency in San Francisco. Are you still doing that or?
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, I made a deal with my partners. I have a few younger partners, and I made a deal to let me go off and finish this book that I'd been working on for like 5 or 6 years. And I just like, I gotta go do this. And so, yeah, I mean, I still, you know, we have Monday morning Zoom meetings. I go to them, but I'm really, I'm only involved from time to time.
Oh, okay. Well, so, I can't remember what year it was, like the early 2000s, I think there was this movie that came out, Almost Famous, by Cameron Crowe. Now, I don't know if people know this. Cameron Crowe, he made Almost Famous. He also made Jerry Maguire, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But people might not know that he started out as a writer for Rolling Stones, and he worked there in the 70s. Did you ever have any run-ins with him when he was a rock writer?
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, the thing about Cameron was he really was like 15 years old when he started. like literally.
Wow.
But I met him when he was, you know, I don't know if he ever wrote for Cream, but all the guys at Cream knew him. And I met him when there was a band called The Tubes. Did people remember that? And they had like one kind of hit.
Yeah. It's escaping me, but I know, I think they have one or two. Yeah.
I can't remember where it was. So they were on their kind of inaugural tour of the States, and Cameron was friends with them and maybe doing a story for Rolling Stone. And by this time he's like, you know, maybe he's 18. I was 20 or 21. I was like, I wasn't much farther ahead of him.
Yeah.
All the stuff that we're talking about, most of it I did when I was, you know, in my early 20s. But Cameron came with The Tubes, and we were there, and you know, it was an occasion. If you put free booze in front of a 21-year-old, you're you know, he's gonna, if he was of my bent, he would drink it. And so we were just shit faced, and I'll tell a tale out of school, because I saw Cameron recently, and I
reminded, oh really?
I reminded him of this. I saw him. They're doing. He's written a musical of Almost Famous.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And we are, the woman who's the Kate played by Kate Hudson in the movie is the person.
Penny Lane.
Penny Lane.
Yeah.
So we're friends with the real Penny Lane, whose name is Penny. She's got a different last name. And so we've become friends with her, and she called us up and said, hey, you want to go see the preview of Almost Famous down in San Diego, which was this past spring. And so we did, and we went down there with her, and, you know, it was, first of all, it's going to be a big hit, but it was supposed to start on Broadway like next month, and sorry, you know, so it's delayed until next year, but it's going to be a hit whenever it comes out. But so Cameron, I reminded him of this incident, but we were watching The Tubes, and he says, oh, hey, I got some Quaaludes, which were, you know, sleeping pills, pretty strong sleeping pills. But
and this is when he's like 15?
No, now he's 18. He's with.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because in the movie, the movie, which is loosely based on his life, he's like 15. He's a kid, and he's like a straight-laced kid, pretty much, in the movie. He doesn't do any drugs or drinking that they show.
Right. I didn't see him take any drugs. He just said, hey, you want some Quaaludes? So I'm like, okay. So he gave me Quaalude. I was already really drunk. And so 20 minutes later, I'm going, Cameron, I don't know what the fuck was with these Quaaludes. They don't work. And so
this is like The Wolf of Wall Street. Did you ever see that movie where the guy does
Yeah, exactly.
It kicks in later, right?
Well, it doesn't kick in 20 minutes, but when you're drunk and your sense of time is distorted. So I took another Quaalude and then went on to have the, you know, most outrageous night of my life, and, you know, lying by the side of the freeway and the crazy guy behind the wheel. It was just, it went on and on. I won't bore you with it, but it wound up, they just couldn't wake me up. So they threw me in the back of this our friend's van.
So it really is like the Wolf of Wall Street, where he's crawling to try to get to the car because he's on Quaaludes and he can't like move his body.
Exactly. Yeah. Only I couldn't move my body at all. They threw me in the back. And Lester was there, and I guess Lester got so fucked up too that I woke up the next morning in Michigan in the middle of winter. I'm like fucking freezing. And I realize I'm lying on the floor of a van, but there's something on top of me. I can't move. And it's Lester. They tossed Lester in on top of me.
So
it was like, fortunately, Lester probably saved me from hypothermia.
So there you go. Yeah. So in the movie Almost Famous, Cameron Crowe's character, the kid character that's based on Cameron Crowe, right. He talks to that publisher. Is that the Philip Seymour Hoffman character? Is that based on Lester Bangs? Was that the guy's name in the movie? I can't remember.
Yeah, he was called Lester.
Okay.
Movie.
So that's totally based on Lester Bangs then, right?
Oh, completely. He was called Lester Bangs in the movie.
Okay. Yeah. I just wasn't.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman was doing an imitation of Lester.
He was
imitating Lester. And in fact, in this musical that's coming out, I guess now next year, Broadway musical, they've really amped up the Lester Bangs part.
Oh.
He's like kind of he does kind of walking commentary throughout the show. And he's the kind of the holder of truth, you know?
Like that part. That line in the movie, where he tells, the young writer kid, hey, don't be friends with the rock stars. They'll make you feel cool, but you're not cool. Do you feel like that's good advice for people in that business? Like as a rock writer? I mean, it sounds like you were friends with a lot of them, or you like at least hung out and partied with them sometimes.
Well, so is Lester. Well, you know, my relationship with rock stars was my relationship with everybody. Anybody who was like more famous than me or richer or whatever, I was always like, rather than letting them put me down, I would put them down. I would tease them. And there were some, the coolest rock stars would think that was funny.
Yeah.
You know, Gene Simmons actually took it really well. I used to.
Yeah. I heard you talk about that.
Torment him.
Is there anyone who didn't take it well?
Oh, I remember I had to go see the band Chicago, who I didn't like.
Oh, you don't like Chicago?
I didn't like Chicago. I mean, maybe they had one or two good songs, but I wasn't a fan.
You really are like a rock critic. Like you hate more stuff than you love, right?
Probably. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, nine out of 10 things are suck. You know, but, I mean, or, you know, when you're younger, I'm like, you know, 99 out of 100 suck. I remember I said something to the guy from one of the guys in Chicago. I don't even remember which one it was. And he was friends with a photographer friend, and the photographer introduced us, and he fucking went ballistic. And I'm like, I know what I said to him. I said, how's your life? And he was in the, so this guy had to be restrained from hitting me. And it was like,
Jesus,
how's your life? What the fuck? And he was like a little guy too. So it wasn't really, it was kind of like, and I'm not a little guy. And anyways, so finally they hauled him off, and I'm like, what the fuck was that? And and my photographer friend said, you said, how's your life? And he thought you said, how's your wife? And he was in the middle of a nasty divorce.
Oh, whoops. Yikes.
So, yeah.
So that wasn't even, you weren't even trying to give him shit. You were just trying to.
Yeah, I was, you know, giving him a kind of a wise guy a greeting.
Okay.
And for some reason, I got thrown out of a dressing room. There's a band I love and I've loved forever. They actually played at my high school called NRBQ. They're one of Keith Richards had said best bar band in the world. And they really are a wonderful band. And they continue to be around, and they've gone through a bunch of changes. But anyways, I remember one day barging backstage when they were playing at a club in New York. And, you know, I was just shit faced again. There was a lot of drinking in those days, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I know, I'm being tossed out of the dressing room. But I have not a clue. And there was nobody there to tell me what happened.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a lot of crazy shit. I don't know, when I watched the Cream documentary, I wasn't like paying super close attention, but some of the stuff that happened, I don't know if you were there when this happened, One of the editors, their dog had taken a crap on the floor. And so somebody took the I think, was this Barry Kramer that took the dog crap and put it in typewriter?
The dog was Lester's. I was not
Lester's.
There.
Okay.
The dog was Lester's. The editor was Dave Marsh. And so
Dave Marsh.
Dave Marsh took the dog shit and stuffed it in Lester's typewriter.
Yeah, and then he didn't he also dump a garbage can on Iggy Pop's head because Iggy Pop had come in and didn't say hi to him, and so then he tried to get his attention.
That was the publisher. He dumped a garbage can on Iggy's head.
That was Kramer, Barry Kramer.
Iggy didn't say hello. Yeah, Barry Kramer.
Yeah, Barry Kramer. Okay.
And you know, and Kramer had been around. He had managed Mitch Ryder and all this stuff. So he knew everybody in the scene, even before Cream.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, we talked a lot about this, you know, mountains of cocaine and the drugs and the drinking and all this crazy stuff. I mean, do you feel like there's like a limit to that? Cause I mean, a lot of these guys did not, you know, they ended up dying too young. Barry Kramer and Lester Bangs, it sounds like they both died way too young. Did they just not know their limits, or did they not know how to slow down as you age, or what's your philosophy on that? Cause I mean, I've had people on my show that, I mean, there's so many people I've had on my show that are like, I'm sober now and this is my lifestyle. And it's like, you know, works out really good for them. And I wonder if those guys just couldn't figure that out. It was too late.
Yeah. You know, I think no doubt saved me. It's a cliche, but was, you know, I met this wonderful woman who was a photographer. And so she was involved in the scene, and the woman who lived with the Blue Oyster called Ronnie Hoffman, and my wife. And having a wife to say, yeah, dude, really, you know, should you be doing that? Just having some sort of stability in your life. And Lester, you know, Lester had a long time, really sweet girlfriend, and she had left. And you know, and that, I think that was the beginning of him not bothering to get control of his impulses. And Kramer too was getting divorced, you know, so he was living in a motel, you know, so you're living in a motel. What are you going to, you know, you're going to be inclined to get high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the same with Lester, you know, he was living next door to me when he died. And,
that's right. You went and didn't they knock on your door and you had to go in there and you're trying to wake him up and he didn't wake up.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
And you're pissed at him for that, right?
Well, I, you know, in the Cream doc, I say, yeah, I was pissed. It's like, you know, dude, when you're down at the county morgue, that's not cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's not cool. And it was, you know, it was New York City, and it was, you know, they're just going to put you into the whole county morgue system. And it takes weeks to do the toxicology tests. And it just seemed like such an ignominious end for a really brilliant man. And also, I think I say this in the Cream doc, is he, you know, it's like cliche.
Yeah.
What a stupid cliche, you know, and Lester would have been the first to call it out. In fact, I was just, somebody sent me something today and it had a whole thing about Lester I was reading. And this guy was saying that, oh, he was quoting something from one of Lester's pieces about the stupid cliche of dying. Mm. And so yes, I think they didn't have some stability. I got lucky. You know, I remember my friend saying to me, I remember my best friend taking me aside and said, oh, you're not going to make it to 30, man. We all want, it was like an intervention. And
damn.
But even at the time, I felt like, even when I was at my most outrageous, I felt like I always knew a little bit what I was doing. And, you know, I had a natural kind of, you know, overenthusiasm. So it wasn't always that I was shit faced. It was just as a guy who liked to really just fuck around.
So. So now you still do that, but you tone it down a little bit because now you're a little older and.
I still like to drink. No. And then here's, you want stability in your life. You know, if you're up to it. So then I had a couple of kids and it's like, all right, you know, you love those kids to pieces. And,
that's great.
And my wife, you know, we moved to California. My wife didn't drive, and I was the only one in the family who drove. And I thought, okay, if I'm shit-faced, you know, that's going to be tough if somebody gets hurt or sick. And to getting them to the hospital. And also the first time I had a hangover and little toddlers were jumping on my head. I will do anything never to have that feeling again.
Gotcha. Well, that's good. I think that's good. You can kind of slow it down, but still have fun.
I basically quit drinking for 20 years. And my kids would tell you, yeah, we never even saw me with a beer can in the hand. It was like, all right, well, if I can't really drink, if I can't get drunk, what's the point? So,
well, that's admirable.
20 years off, and now I've been back on it. But I'm not, nothing like I used
to. No. It's not the 70s anymore. You can't.
And it's also, your head is just not there.
How else is the music scene changed from the 70s today? I mean, I want to hear it in your words. I mean, I know obviously it's totally different, but what would you say is the biggest differences in music from the 70s to today?
Well, music is it was the center of the universe back in those days. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything, you know, that was the culture was, you know, you defined yourself by what music you listened to. And I think that persisted through the 70s, maybe into the 80s. You know, I don't know if it was MTV that helped undo it, but then, and hip hop came along. Now, if you include hip hop in the kind of rock and roll rubric, I think, you know, hip hop is a form of rock and roll. I think the music has been very exciting the last 20, 30 years. I mean, there's been great hip hop, the punk era and the post-punk era was great. You know, Nirvana. Now, Nirvana's ancient history to people today. But
have you heard the new Cardi B song, WAP?
Oh, I've only heard about it.
Okay.
I haven't listened to it. You know, I think of maybe I shouldn't, but I think of that. It's like, okay, that's like kind of, you know, showbiz. It's like,
kind of like Kiss.
Know. Is it good? And well, I'll listen to it, but it's, you know, I mean, I loved like the first Kanye, bless his troubled heart. I loved his first record that I just went crazy for that.
Okay.
You know, Lil Wayne, I loved some of that Lil Wayne stuff. The 90s, I remember I fell in love with the Guided by Voices. One of my all-time favorite bands. You know, I go for that kind of popish stuff. Oh, who was I into? I was into Mars Volta and At the Drive-In before that. Mars Volta, I love. These are people I bought tickets to go see, you know.
Okay.
I loved them. I think the last rock interview I was supposed to do was with Robert Pollard of Guided by Voices, and he flaked on it.
So. Well, so tell me about the new book. We talked a little bit about it here and there, but it's called Loudmouth. I know that. And it's basically like a fictional novel based on kind of your reality. You changed some of the names of the characters and such. But, you know, tell us about that a little bit.
Well, all the stories I've been telling you, pretty much they're all.
Okay.
And except I cut the Liza thing out. But it's a coming-of-age novel, and so it's not just all rock and roll shit, although it hints at why the character in the book, which is me thinking about my own, got involved in rock and roll. You know, I came out of a background of a Southern family, and it could be like, let's just call it dysfunctional at times.
Okay.
And spent a lot of time in Memphis too, because they're, you know, we were this deep South and they were they weren't into this whole thing of rock and roll and everything. So it's a coming of age novel about the guy who goes through all that shit, rebels, becomes a singer in a band and becomes a, you know, kind of a notably wild singer, and then and winds up at Cream Magazine.
Awesome.
And before finding the love of his life, this woman, this photographer woman who he meets by this weird serendipity, and it's like, how does it's kind of covers from this guy growing up and being crazy and then crashing and then kind of getting it all sorted out.
Cool. All right. Well, look forward to that. Do you have a charity that you work with or that you want to promote? I think I told your manager, hopefully he told you about how I end each episode with a charity.
Well, you know, I do.
Okay.
The charity I'm supporting is the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, which is, you know, standing up for all of us, but especially for Black people, African American people in this country, which is something obviously we need much more of. But they're a wonderful charity. They've been around for a long time, and they're, you know, if you go on like one of those charity sites like Charity Navigator to see how good is this charity, how much of their money goes to the cause instead of administration. It's like they get like an A for they really so put their money where
it's just called the Legal Counsel for NAACP. Legal Defense Fund. Okay, cool. I will put that in the notes of this episode. You've done some amazing things. The Loudmouth book is coming out. Everyone should get that. Do you have any future plans? Like, would you like to do a sequel to the Kiss book? Because since that was your biggest hit. And I'd advise you to say yes, because if you say yes, then we could probably get some headlines from this interview.
Well, if it helps you and it would help me.
Right?
I'm telling you, a Kiss
A lot book, has happened from 78 since you wrote the first book, and then you could package them together as a two-pack.
I hadn't really thought about it, but it's a funny idea. And maybe I should do a sequel. Maybe I should.
Okay.
I would approach it in my own way, like I did the original book.
It would have to be
somewhat tongue in cheek.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, you heard it here first.
How much of their music I could listen to, but
yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, that's a really funny idea. No, I mean, I have a couple other books in the works.
Okay.
And I have a nonfiction thing that I've been working on. And, The nonfiction thing I've been writing for the last several years. I've put it on hold. It's a blog. It's really a book I've been writing, but I piece it out once a week or once every few weeks. It's about an Italian restaurant in the town I live in that is the book is called Center of the Universe, and it's run by these Brazilian Korean sisters, and who are like kind of Pied Pipers, and everybody in the town and our town. I live in this town full of musicians and artists, and it's a lot of really wacky people, characters.
Wow.
So this restaurant is just this wonderful place where one of the sisters who is the front of the house one will say, "Hey, I'm going to seat this guy with you tonight. You know, you should get to know this guy." And the town is crazy. So
we'll look for that too. So people can follow you on social media to get updates, check out your website. I think is it duncanwrites.com or
Duncan Writes, like writes words.
Yeah. And then, you're on Instagram and Facebook. Are you on Twitter?
Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and the links are all on duncanwrites.com.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. There we go. I'll put that in the notes as well. Well, thank you so much for coming on my show. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it. My honor, my pleasure.
All right.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. All right. Bye-bye. All right. So am I right? Is that not one of the better episodes of my show? If you made it this far, then I think you have to agree. Just such great stories from Robert. I'll have to have him on again for sure, because there was a lot more that we didn't cover. But make sure you follow Robert on social media for updates on his new book, Loudmouth, and the other projects he has, maybe a new Kiss book. You can follow me on social media if you like. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend and make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you really want to do me a solid, you can write me a review, as that really helps with the iTunes algorithm so people can find the podcast. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and I hope you have a great day or night. And remember to shoot for the moon.